Major support for Louisiana Eats on WWNO provided by Zatarain's, proud producers of authentic New Orleans-style cuisine. Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889.
From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. On this week's edition, we're going to the MASH, the Brooklyn Brewery MASH, that is. When this multi-city roadshow rolls into town, elements of local food, art, music, and film, accompanied by a lot of delicious craft beer, make for some serious fun. Louisiana was one of the first stops on this year's tour, and we've got all the key players. Brooklyn Brewery chef Andrew Gerson, Vendy Awards producer Helena Tubis, and Joe Che of Chaos Cooking, here for the full MASH treatment. I'll also share some of my favorite ways to use beer in cooking and in cocktails. So let's pop the top and get the party started on this week's Louisiana Eats. In the early 1980s, Steve Hindy and Tom Potter came together to revive the tradition of great craft beer in New York. The partners founded Brooklyn Brewery, and along with brewmaster Garrett Oliver, they not only succeeded in brewing excellent beer, but have played a key role in the revitalization of Brooklyn itself. Now, Brooklyn Brewery is sharing their vision of great food and great beer across America with a traveling roadshow they call The MASH. We captured key players Meg Stemmler, Andrew Gerson, and Helena Tubis for an in-depth look at the Louisiana version of the Brooklyn MASH. So I think we should begin, perhaps with you, Meg, explaining to us what and why the Brooklyn MASH exists.
So the Brooklyn Brewery has a long history of working in the community, supporting arts programs, especially food and beer related. We've been very successful in Manhattan and Brooklyn doing programming for the past 2 decades, and we wanted to take that model on the road and share it with other cities where we have distribution.
Give me a for instance of the kind of events that for the last 20-plus years they've been hosting in Brooklyn.
I would say that it's a two-part thing. We have a very robust sponsorship program. So we donate a certain amount of beer every year to major institutions, cultural institutions, in addition to nonprofit organizations. Beer dinners, obviously, that would be one of our strongest kind of events. And they often feature our brewmaster, Garrett Oliver.
Out of all of these unlikely people that you have brought together, what to you has been the most inspiring mashup?
I think that the Slow Supper event is a really great way to bring different chefs together and to bring our favorite people from New York and match them up with more unknowns. For example, in Austin, we got to have the pleasure of having Marcus Samuelson, who founded our media partner, Food Republic, that'll be on tour with us throughout the year. He was there preparing a meal with our house chef, Andrew. A majority of our guests there were farmers.
Oh,
and that to
great.
Us was an amazing thing.
Yes.
Because we sit around with 80 people at this incredible, I don't even know how many courses we had, 15 course meal outside, and we're sharing it with people who made that possible.
And Andrew, now you are relatively new in this position as Brooklyn Brewery's house chef. And as I understand it, you're coming on because this is the year they're really fleshing out the food piece at Brooklyn Brewery. Talk to me about that.
I think it's about making just a deeper cultural connection. And food and beer have been staples for so many, you know, for all of eternity, for existence,
well,
for the last 4,000 years. And I think it's really about just bringing good food and good beer to good people. So a lot about what this tour is about is sharing in the rich cultures of every city that we're going to, but also bringing a little Brooklyn funk and flavor.
Yeah, that is one of the reasons that I was so interested in this project and really wanted to talk with you all on Louisiana Eats because, you know, I talked to some food writers and people who do things sort of like what I do, and they were like, well, what is this? They're coming to New Orleans to put on a Brooklyn beer event. Like, what's in it for us? And I was so happy that I could jump in and say, well, actually, there's a lot in it for us. And one of the things that pointed me in that direction immediately is Helena Tubis, the managing director of the Vendy Awards, which is an annual competition that identifies the top street vendors really all across the U.S. So welcome, Helena, and tell me, explain the Vendys and how it started and give us some background on that.
For sure. Like Brooklyn Brewery, the Vendy Awards started in New York and it was born out of a nonprofit organization called the Street Vendor Project. It's an organization that's been around for 11 years now. So 9 years ago in a small East Village garage, we brought three vendors together, about 150 people, and we decided to start the Vendy Awards. It was a great success, and this year we're expecting over 2,000 people in New York City.
So it all started in a garage, and how big is it this year?
So we're going to have about over 2,000 people, over 25 vendors, and about 3 years ago, we decided to start exploring work in other cities. First, we went to Los Angeles and then to Philadelphia, both cities that have thriving street food cultures but also face challenges. And we wanted to broaden our view of what street food is outside of New York, learn from other organizations that were doing work on the streets.
What are the challenges that you're referring to?
Legislative primarily, so dealing with antiquated laws that were set up many, many years ago to deal with issues that are just very different right now.
Well, you all got to New Orleans just in the nick of time.
We sure did.
I'm really active with the Food Truck Coalition, and we've covered it a lot on Louisiana Eats, the scene in Baton Rouge as well as in New Orleans. And, wow, it's a process. And I have tried to explain to people repeatedly that if you don't have a thriving food truck culture, you're missing in the 21st century an essential element of culinary entrepreneurism.
It really is. It's forever been a gateway for new business owners, you know, from peddlers on the Lower East Side. Bloomingdale's was started on a street cart. So it's an opportunity, a small-scale opportunity for people who are interested in doing business on their own to really get their feet wet.
Describe what a Vendy Award evening goes like, Helena.
Well, the Vendy Awards is about eating and drinking and celebrating what we think are some unsung culinary heroes. We're having vendors that, you know, some have food trucks and some vend at festivals and some vend on the street on the corner in their neighborhood. It's about celebrating them mainly, but there's music and it's a community event. It's about having a good time and trying lots of different food.
So, Meg, maybe you can describe for us when the Brooklyn Brewery Mash hits a U.S. city, what people can expect.
I think people can expect a mix of different events. The mash is one of the first phases of the brewing process. And part of the reason for the name of the event series is that we're trying to hit a lot of different things in a lot of different communities, food and beer being two of the main things. But then we go into film, literature, music. We do our beer tastings. But as we were sort of dreaming up the perfect sort of ideal dream scenario, we started talking to different partners. One of our partners is a company called Together.
Together, yeah, is the literary partner, yes, in this, correct?
Yes. So Together was founded to help connect the audience member to the author. I think in the modern day, it's been a problem for authors to be able to have a successful book tour, and it's very expensive. So publishers aren't paying for it anymore. So this way, they have the platform there to know what audience is available if they go to a city. They're not going to be playing to empty rooms. They're not going to be talking to empty seats. So we're helping make that happen by connecting a Brooklyn speaker or author with a local speaker or author and really making that community come together.
Oh, that's so great.
Yeah.
And give me another few elements of the MASH.
So Found Footage is a film screening party hosted by Found Footage Festival. The concept is that they show screenings of video clips that they've actually found themselves at in garage sales or flea markets across the country.
So it's literally found footage, and then they create new art out of it.
Absolutely. And they pick outrageous clips. They have stuff that's very humorous, things that are historical. A lot of their evenings are just these amazing, hilarious evenings of all these different clips that they find. What I find most interesting about them is they have more material from VHS tapes than anyone. Literally, the Library of Congress reached out to them because they have this archive of amazing footage. And they bring that all across the country to movie theaters and have an hour-long screening, and then they have a party afterward.
So, Andrew, I know that you are a long-time slow food supporter like myself, and I was really blown away when I discovered that you've actually studied at the University of Gastronomic Sciences, which is the most amazing slow food college. And so you must have had a hand in creating the partnership between the Brooklyn Brewery MASH and Slow Food USA.
Well, actually, long before I even knew what slow food was, Garrett Oliver, our brewmaster, was on the founding board of Slow Food USA. Him and Alice were were pretty essential in forming this group. And you know, the U.S. chapters are almost larger than the European now. So how Slow Food has spread and sort of progressed, you know, has
it's
a lot
amazing.
To do in part to our brewery or the staff, you know,
exactly.
who have become, you know, an integral pillar of our brewery. One of the reasons I was hired for this position is my approach and philosophy to food. And I think it's so in line with that of the breweries where, you know, they're making real beer. And it's really important that we all advocate, whether it be food, beer, or culture, this, not even a return, a moving forward where we honor ingredients, we honor people and cultures, and we try and preserve tradition, but also innovate and create enjoyment. So much of what slow food is about pleasure.
Yes.
And conviviality and being at the table. And I think that this MASH tour is about that. We have events like Slow Suppers where we're working with Slow Food. In Austin, we were on Springdale Farm with 80 people under these lights on a 1.5-acre, you know, working farm in an urban environment in East Austin. And here we're doing one with Dinner Lab, a swamp-themed dinner, sort of honoring the bayou and all of these amazing
swamp
to table. And it's honoring what's here and what's available. And, you know, we're at the market this morning when we bumped into you, and there's these amazing fresh strawberries, and we're right at the end of citrus season. And when I'm doing these demos at the farmer's markets, I want to use what's there and what's available and these beautiful shrimp that are coming right from the Gulf.
When we come back from a short break, the Brooklyn MASH conversation continues. Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Louisiana was one of the first stops for a new roadshow concept from Brooklyn Brewery, the MASH. Our conversation about the mashup of local food, art, music, film, and fun continues with the MASH team, Meg Stemmler, Helena Tubis, and Chef Andrew Gerson. What's the ultimate goal in the long range and the long run of putting on an 11-city, year-long event from the Brooklyn
community
Brewery?
I really think that the Brooklyn Brewery stands for community, and I think that's why we're so in love with Brooklyn. And I think everywhere we go, it's about building that and just extending our community across the country. Whether it's with chefs or artists or business owners, I think that there's a common denominator of the passion for what we do. Whether it's being really interested in craft beer or slow suppers or farm-to-table events, I think that there's just a seriousness about the craft of it all.
What has been the most challenging part of mashing all this together?
I think the fact that it's the beginning and teaching people what you are. I think it's also challenging being a brewery and people can perceive you as sort of coming into their community corporate.
They could be confused and think you're Anheuser-Busch.
Exactly. Well, that is an issue, and it takes a couple extra minutes on the phone or a longer email and some links to some of our amazing partners to show them what we're really about. It's never been about a fast buck for Brooklyn Brewery. It's always been about relationships. From the beginning, Steve Hindy, he's a staple in Brooklyn. Wherever he walks around the neighborhood, people know who he is.
Steve Hindy and Tom Potter, of course, are the co-founders of Brooklyn Brewery.
Yes, and I think that Andrew and I are both new to the company, and I think that one of the things that excited us most about working there is you feel a real sense of integrity. And I have a lot of pride in working for the company because it has a strong history. It feels like it's going to have a very strong future. And even the fact that they're taking this opportunity to go out on the road and give us a creative platform and give us the support and infrastructure to do that is an amazing next step for the future of Brooklyn Brewery, I think.
Andrew, have you done this kind of crazy thing on the road before, or is this mash thing your first jump out and find the food and cook it?
I have dreamt about doing these things. It's a dream job. I'm kind of dynamic. I get very bored. I don't like to be stagnant. And this is a job that provides, like Meg said, an integrity, a company that I could work for and feel proud of being a part of their vision. Steve Hindy wrote this book, Beer School. I was in tears. I mean, it's a passionate story full of this energy, and it's an entrepreneurial spirit. It's different people coming together, all playing a role to build a company that, as it's, I mean, we've quadrupled our size in the last 4 years.
Yeah, it's incredible.
And it's a family. I mean, I've been accepted into an office in this environment, and after a month, given the support to go out on the road and live the way I want to, meeting new people and cooking and doing all these things with this structure behind me that's so supportive in every aspect.
Right.
And we
really get to let other people shine.
Yeah.
Which is so fun.
So when the circus comes to town, which is kind of what this is.
Absolutely.
You know, often it rolls in on the railroad cars, or it comes in van by van by van. What's the road kit look like for the Brooklyn Brewery mash?
It's pretty simple.
Meg's got matching luggage.
Yeah. We have a couple laptops.
You got your kit.
What are you cooking
with,
Andrew?
Well, I got to say, Brooklyn Kitchen, they are an incredible, dynamic space. A couple blocks from my home, right between my house and the brewery.
What is it, Brooklyn Kitchen?
Brooklyn Kitchen is just amazing. Brooklyn Kitchen kind of combines a gourmet market with high-end kitchen equipment, two demo kitchens where they're doing classes all day. They have a butcher shop inside called the Meat Hook, where I actually did an internship.
And an interview.
And my interview for the job, so it's this really interesting cycle.
They do book signings.
And they sponsored a kit for us. So I have my little, my mobile kitchen. I got all
the... You basically went on a shopping spree.
I got all the toys that I wanted to play with on this trip and felt a little more secure. I mean, I had my knife roll, and now I have this huge pack, and it's one suitcase. And I'm traveling.
He's definitely learned fast how to be very mobile.
But a wise man once told me, a man is nothing without his tools. So we're very thankful to Brooklyn Kitchen for providing us with a lot of the tools necessary to make this trip happen.
That's fabulous. So. Now, when finally you get to the end of the road, of the road part of the event, I understand that you've got a pretty cool new kitchen facility back at the brewery waiting for you. Would you tell me about that?
I sure will. I'm very excited. We are slated to launch a new kitchen at the Brooklyn Brewery. We're calling it at the moment a demo kitchen. It's a space where we'll probably do pop-up dinners 2 to 3 nights a week, one communal table, coursed meals, sort of similar to a lot of the formatting we're doing here, like a slow supper where there'll be a beer pairing. It'll be a space where I can do all the canning, curing, pickling, things that I want to do. One interesting aspect is every city that we're going to mm-hmm. on the tour, from every farmer's market, I've been getting product, jarring it. So when we go back, we'll have this sort of visual wall of either pickled or preserved products. You know, Chris Shepherd in Houston gave us, from Underbelly Restaurant, gave us some pickled pig feet. On Springdale Farm in Austin, I was took all the strawberries and baby carrots and pickled those. One of the chefs I'm working with today just told me he can give me some cauliflower that he just pickled. So we're sort of acquiring this beautiful montage of edible artwork to display on the walls. But yeah, this kitchen is going to be a chance to sort of also invite a lot of the chefs and people we've been working with on these tours to come back to Brooklyn and do a dinner.
That's fantastic. One of the most fascinating facts that I learned in my research about Brooklyn Brewery's place in the world today is that I understand it that they are most likely the biggest exporter mm-hmm. of American craft beer to the rest of the world. Would anybody like to talk to that fact? Because I think people think of beer coming in because of all the old world European beers, but I don't.
Absolutely. And I think
going
if
out
you look
thing.
At, I think one strong point is Brooklyn, mm-hmm. is Milton Glaser creating this B that sort of encompasses all of what Brooklyn is within that bee. And I think the mash kind of does that. It's this cultural, like, it's like the Batman bee. It's like the symbol. It's got this sort of iconic Brooklyn. So people, I think, start off with, in other countries, I think New York is celebrated after doing a 2-year master's in Italy. Oh, you're from America, New York. It's at times very highly celebrated. But then there's this quality factor. Mm-hmm. You know, our brewmaster was inspired on his trips to Europe about the quality of beer that was there. And I think even you look at a lot of Belgian producers are no longer doing, for instance, bottle re-fermentation mm-hmm. in the traditional way. I really feel that the quality we put into our beers, from the ingredients to the procedures to the alchemy and the yeasts that we're using that are transforming, you know, this wort, this liquid into this magical beverage that everyone loves and enjoys.
Yeah, it's an active, live bit of magic. It truly is.
That quality that we have and the balance in flavors. I mean, and that's what attracted me to the brewery is it has all these different elements that are so well balanced. Mm-hmm. And I think that our beers are appreciated in Europe coming from traditions of really high quality beverages, you know,
that's
whether it's wine or beer. We've had success because the name is alluring, the branding is alluring, but the product is actually amazing. And that, to me, is why we are able to expand into any market that we're in and be successful.
I think it's important to note that it's a really special time to be in Brooklyn. Brooklyn Brewery played a big part in the revitalization of the neighborhood and the borough. And I think that anything with Brooklyn in its name right now is getting attention.
Yeah.
Our second largest market is Sweden, and they are extremely passionate and interested in Brooklyn culture. And everywhere we go, having that as part of our name says something about who we are. We helped develop that. That's where we started back in the 80s. And at the time, it was not a popular name to have in your title of the company.
Really?
People advising Steve Hindy about it were kind of like, Brooklyn Brewery, that's going to be the name of your beer, huh? Because it wasn't the best place to live or start a company. But he had a vision for what was going to happen. He was going to be part of developing it. And it's kind of exciting that we get to come on board at this time of revitalization and go out on the road and share that with people.
Well, I just want to wish you all the luck in the world with this. And, you know, I always think the sky's the limit. So it seems that the next Brooklyn Brewery MASH tour is going to be like the world tour maybe, huh?
Actually, we are. There's something we do in Sweden called Brooklyn Sweden.
Oh!
And this will be our second year, and it's when we bring a lineup of Brooklyn bands, and we're doing the same thing in Manchester in November as well.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming to talk with us.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
It was such a pleasure. Thank you for having us.
Meg Stemmler, Helena Tubas, and Andrew Gerson of Brooklyn Brewery. Ales and lagers are not just for pairing with food, but also contribute an incredible depth of flavor when mixing cocktails or cooking. While most home cooks may not have a long-simmered stock ready and waiting in the refrigerator, it's a good guess there's a beer in there somewhere. Even if it's a mass-produced can of light beer, beer adds more flavor to a dish in need of a little liquid than just water. So have a sip of beer, then use the rest to deglaze a pan for a little gravy, or use it for braising, poaching, or steaming anything from heavy meat dishes to light, lovely fish fillets. Light lagers are great in cream soups or mixed into frying batters. A beer reduction makes a great glaze for pork or chicken and adds a magical touch to a barbecue sauce. I think hot dogs and hot sausages are always better when simmered in beer before they hit the grill. With the proliferation of sweeter, fruity brews, beer can give your dessert an interesting twist as well. Macerate fresh fruit in a sweeter beer before adding it to cakes and puddings. Sparkling wines and sodas have long been incorporated into cocktails, so why not use beer to add a bubbly little lift to a mixed drink? Recently, I've seen beer used in classics like mimosas, sangria, and spicy Bloody Marys. Nowadays, beer is for a lot more than just quenching your thirst on a hot day. Visit our Louisiana Eats website at wwno.org to learn creative new uses for your favorite beer. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Louisiana Eats culinary heritage heroes are farmers, fishers, chefs, and food producers who bring an authentic taste of our state's heritage to the world's tables. This week's hero was born along the Lazy Bayou Teche. He grew up in a traditional Cajun agrarian lifestyle on a big family farm, but as a young man joined the U.S. Army Cavalry, leaving behind the small town of Arnoville that his ancestors had called home since the Grand Déragement.
We live on some family farm. It's all my brothers, my parents all live on this farm. My parents' house dates back to the 1860s. And it's still a farmhouse. There's a crawfish pond on the property, a bean field. We have horses. And it just gives us the right vibe, I think, for what we're trying to portray with our beers.
While stationed overseas in Germany, our heritage hero first discovered the complicated tastes of European beer. His voyage continued at his next posting in Fort Lewis, Washington. The microbrewery movement was in full swing in the Pacific Northwest during the early 1990s, and our heritage hero studied the techniques of the brewmasters and began his own experimentations in brewing beer.
It's not brewed anywhere in the world right now. Everyone's moved on to lager yeast for this style of beer. Lager yeast is only about 150 years old. Before that, everybody would have used ale yeast. And we wanted to use the ale yeast on this style, because our ancestors would have brought over, there's a lot of Germans in Louisiana, they would have brought over this beer with them. And they would have drank that with the old Creole foods. So we wanted to brew something that A, went with our cuisine, and then B, harkened back to our past.
Our heritage hero retired from the armed service to return to Arnoville, where he and his two brothers, Byron and Dorsey, began to formulate a plan to create a brewery of their own, naming it Bayou Teche Brewery.
all of our beers are built around a story that we want to keep. It's not like we design the beer and the story separate. We want them together because they're both important. And we kind of want to perpetuate those ways of life.
That's why this week's Louisiana Eats Culinary Heritage Hero is Carlos Knott of Bayou Teche Brewery. Congratulations, Carlos. Your beer is the perfect accompaniment for the vivid flavors of real Louisiana Eats. Sometimes chaos in your kitchen can be a good thing. When we come back, Chaos Cooking co-creators Margaret Geer and Joe Che join us with Johnny Watson, the very brave host of Chaos Cooking New Orleans Style. Stay with us. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Market. Baton Rouge-based food writer and photographer Frank McManus is a regular contributor to Country Roads magazine. He's also our Louisiana Eats roving reporter, and he always has some hot new food finds just for us. Frank, what's new on the road?
Well, one of my favorite places in Baton Rouge is a little gelato shop called Latte Miele that's been open since 2009. Kind of outside of town. It wasn't in the most convenient location to get to. It was sort of on your way to New Orleans. But they've moved into the central city over off of Jefferson Highway, kind of near the Whole Foods area, near Beausoleil, which is another fantastic restaurant we should talk about sometime. But they've expanded since they've moved. They're not doing just gelato and espresso anymore. They're doing some great light lunch items, and they're about to roll out a seasonal dinner menu that'll be served Wednesday through Sunday. So,
wow. Are they making panini in there?
They're making several sandwiches that are Italian in their origin. There's a porchetta that's sort of pulled pork type sandwich, but not flavored with the traditional American barbecue style flavors, but more Italian flavors. They do an eggplant caponata sandwich, but they're not the pressed panini sandwiches. They generally tend to be on lighter French bread or a multigrain kind of a thing.
What are the gelato flavors you always seek out when you go there?
Well, to date, they've done over 175 different flavors, including some that have used poached pear, ones that rely on whatever seasonal ingredients are out there, whether it's Louisiana strawberries or blueberries or mint or that kind of thing. I'm honestly a bit of a purist. I like their namesake eponymous gelato, the Latte Miele, which is, just means milk and honey. It's got that fabulous richness that's so characteristic of gelato. It's very nicely sweetened with honey, but they'll also do like a Bananas Foster gelato. They're very experimental, and I have yet to taste a failed experiment. So that's a lot to say.
So they're great adventurers. How is the ambiance different between the two places?
Well, the old place was very much a gelato shop. You know, it was pretty much dominated by the gelato cases and the espresso machine. In keeping with their expanded menu, there are a lot more items around, a lot of shelves with different Italian specialties and that sort of thing. But there's a great, very space age sort of contemporary looking gelato case that also holds some of their pastry items that they do. And there's just a real clean design kind of approach. The furniture is very contemporary, mixed in with a lot of salvaged wood pieces. You can really go and not only enjoy some spectacular food, but really soak in some ambiance that had sort of been lacking in Baton Rouge for a long time. And they've got a great little outdoor area that you can go sit in and, you know, enjoy your gelato or your espresso out on the veranda and watch the world go by.
Well, that sounds fascinating. It sounds like a little touch of Milan right there in Baton Rouge.
It very much is. It really, really is. It will remind anyone who has been to Italy of a lot of the contemporary Northern Italian, both inspired cuisine and design.
Well, Frank, I want to thank you so much for taking us on another fascinating food trip with you.
My pleasure.
Louisiana Eats roving reporter Frank McMahon. All the crawfish craziness at this time of year, it's easy to forget about the oyster. Louisiana oysters are absolutely at their best right now and will stay that way right into early summer. True, oysters are a little scarce and cost a little bit more, but they're fat, salty, and delicious when you can get them. It's easy to make an ethereal oyster bisque, incorporating a blonde roux, some seasoning vegetables, thyme, and bay. The most important ingredient is oyster liquor. In Louisiana, we're lucky to be able to buy extra oyster liquor from the seafood purveyor. That's the salty juices that run from the oysters as they're being shucked, and flavor-wise, it's pure gold. Shucked oysters come packed in some of their liquor, but if you can't get extra oyster water, make some by whirling a couple of oysters in cold water in the food processor or blender. I like to add blanched Idaho potatoes to my bisque, adding them with green onions and raw oysters 5 minutes before serving. Be careful. As soon as the oyster's edges just start to curl, they're done. Finish with heavy cream or half and half and serve immediately. Before the heat of the summer sets in, make a meal of oyster bisque. For a copy of this recipe, visit our website at wwno.org. You're listening to Louisiana Eats. Experienced chaos in your kitchen before. Well, that's something that Joe Che and his co-creator Margaret Gear are pros at. They're here to talk about chaos cooking with their New Orleans chaos host, Johnny Watson. Hi guys, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Hello. Hi. Pleasure to be here.
So, Margaret and Joe, let's just start at the beginning. What is chaos cooking?
Well, basically, it's just one person hosts, strangers, friends, everyone gets together and cooks a recipe while drinking, eating, talking.
Yeah, I would summarize it as not a new idea, but a way to structure and organize it. So it's a cooking community, international cooking community, that really is based on a simple premise of bringing the ingredients, cooking together, bringing either drinks. In this case, for the MASH tour, Brooklyn Brewery is giving us all this great beer, which is awesome. And then just cooking and conversing with friends, friends of friends, and strangers.
So what was the inspiration behind Chaos Cooking?
I would say that the inspiration, it was my birthday 3 years ago, and I was really missing family, missing that feeling that you get when you have your entire family in the kitchen, and everybody's kind of chatting, and there's no real plan, and everyone's kind of doing their thing, and you're bouncing off each other and getting each other's way, and you got a glass of wine or a beer in one hand and a knife in the other, and, you know, at the end, everything just works out, and you're catching up with people. And so that was the idea, is just to try to do that, to have that feeling of family with friends.
So give me some for instances about what are you cooking? Do you come up with a theme or a recipe, or how organized is your chaos?
I would say the organization is really, it's more of a process. The process is simple. Someone decides to host. They decide who to open it up to. just friends or friends of friends or strangers. And some hosts decide to have a theme, Italian night, Cajun night, or a color, or someone did alcohol-based theme. All your ingredients had to have an alcohol in it. So it could be a theme, but it's more about just getting people together and cooking.
And you all have actually pulled this off internationally. What countries have you created chaos in?
A lot of them. It all sort of happened by accident. I wish we could take more credit for it, but unfortunately we can't. It's more of we started in Brooklyn, and we had just our close friends over. We had 18 people cooking at the same time, and we thought we were nutcases for doing that. And next time it was 25, and we thought that was crazy. And we started to realize that no matter how we did it, the feeling was always the same. It felt like family bouncing off each other in the kitchen. Now, my understanding is down here, you guys do that all the time.
Well, it is kind of something that we're good at. Yeah.
That's what I've heard. So Johnny over here has made it very clear that this is going to be one of the craziest ones. So
yeah, Johnny, so you're the host. How did you get brave enough to volunteer your home for this event? How do you even prepare for chaos cooking?
I don't. Makes it easy, takes the stress off of me. So I don't know. I got a great roommate and plenty of open space. Got a big backyard, big front yard, live off a dead end street, and I've talked to the neighbors that are closest to the end of the street. So if we gotta throw some tables in the street and whatnot, we'll do that. We'll just have workspaces for everybody to cook, you know, enjoy drinks and have a good time. So when I first moved down here, I didn't even eat seafood, but I ended up cooking gumbo with Miss Antoinette, and from that day on, I was like, so you can't get me away from any place that doesn't have delicious seafood all the time and for super cheap, you know? And just some of these events that happen around a kitchen table were absolutely life-changing. I mean, I had okra for the first time with John Scott in his home with his wife, and it was just life-changing. You don't know that that's happening at the time. Then you look back and you're like, wow, that really is a significant time in my life that happened just around a casual dinner table in Louisiana. So
how do y'all handle it from a logistics point of view with cutlery, dishware, glasses to drink out of? What do you do?
Well, I think it depends on the host. Really, whatever they have, they'll usually post it on the event page and just let guests know if they'll supply dishes, if they want them to bring their own plate and cup and cutlery. Yeah, so it's either provided or they bring their own.
One thing I just got to comment on is chaos cooking is less about the amount of people and more about the concept, the idea that it's unstructured. If you were going to come to the house, instead of like, you know, a potluck is where everyone goes home, they do it, they're individual. They bring everything. By the time it gets to the house, it's cold. There's no communication. There's no participation. With this is you're next to each other. You're doing things together. You know, you're collaborating. Oh, what are you making? Oh, let's put this together. Let's try this. Oh, now that it's done, you know, you're going, you're feeding everybody, you know. You're eating nonstop for 5 hours instead of sitting down at a dinner table. So it's more about the process. Because I would say we have chaos cookings that are a lot of fun, that are 15 people, that are 20 people, that aren't crazy. Johnny has hit the roof with this thing. I can't even, this may be the craziest one that will ever happen. We've done recently in New York, 150 person one on Valentine's Day.
Was that your largest to date?
That was largest that I'm aware of, yeah. And it worked out great, super fun. These women that got involved with Chaos Cooking, they really went all out and got all these drinks. Brooklyn Brewery was there, provided. They had all these tables they rented, extra stoves, all these hot plates all over the place. They had a photo booth, but it was very large. Most of them are 15 people, 25 people getting together in an apartment, in a house. And the idea is, you know, it's to create community around cooking.
Did people ever just come and riff on available ingredients?
I've never... No, because the whole concept is to pick a dish and bring the ingredients.
Okay.
That way everyone, it's very fair. Although definitely people are riffing off each other's. We've seen people make a homemade ice cream and a Banana Foster's, and then they decided, wouldn't it be great, you know, to put the homemade ice cream on the Banana Foster's or things like that. Someone was making sushi, someone was making something else, and yeah, they definitely collaborate for sure.
When you were in Budapest, when you were in these foreign places where English is not the first language, how were you communicating the chaos concept?
Through the local host. So the idea is it's less about Margaret and I, and it's more about Johnny. You know, when someone gets the concept, they translate that concept the way that they want to see it done. For some people, for Johnny, it means getting two food trucks, a snowball truck, and, you know, having tables in the front yard, backyard, and on, I don't know, upside down on the roof. You know, for some people, it might be getting 15 of their closest friends together and just cooking and drinking, you know. To answer your question, you know, when we were in Amsterdam, most people spoke English where we were, honestly. But it's really just the host.
How do you promote it?
We don't. It's like when I said earlier, it was, I wish we could take more credit for it. It's really, we had this idea, we did it, and we got little media attention. We didn't have a website, we didn't have anything. We just kept hearing all these stories of people doing the same thing with the same name, with the same concept. And we're like, hey, if people like this idea, maybe we should make it easy for them to do it. Let's create structure so that in three clicks of a button, anyone can do this. So what we really feel like our job is at this point is to create the tools so that we can have a centralized place where if you wanted to host one, you'd go on, put in your email, your zip code, hit two buttons, and now you have 30 people that you're cooking with. And you may know some of them. You invited your friends, but you might have a couple people that you don't know. And they end up being just as cool as the people that you do know. And now you have best friends. And we have a trust system on there. But we've never had a problem. We've had thousands and thousands of people into our home, and we've never once had a problem.
No, so. In fact, we've actually had many of our friends start dating from it. We have friends come to us like a year later, and they're like, oh, don't you know that my best friend I actually met at a chaos cooking?
Yeah.
Well, that's just fantastic. I'm so glad I had a chance to capture you here for Louisiana Eats, and I really appreciate you bringing a little chaos into the studio with us today. So thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Margaret Geer, Joe Che, and Johnny Watson of Chaos Cooking.
It's a groovy scene, and everybody clean and feeling good. Oh, baby. People finding pleasure in each other.
That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Next week, we'll hear about life on the road with some of this year's Jazz Fest performers.
We never fail to eat well in Destin. Speaking of food, that's one of the places.
And it's such a different thing in the studio. You want to be working most of the time, so it's just quick sandwiches in the kitchen, back in the studio. With the road, you know, you have a 4-hour show and maybe 2-hour sound check, and the rest of the day you don't have anything to do besides travel. So we do get a little more creative with restaurants and stuff when we're on the road.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at wwno.org. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support provided by Dickie Brennan and Company, Lightsegan and Westside Lightsegan Funeral Homes, LCI Workers' Comp, and our media sponsor, Louisiana Kitchen and Culture Magazine. Theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes, produced at Piety Street Recording. Thanks to producer and sound engineer Thomas Walsh and our editor, Zoe Sullivan. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO.